This episode of the Pain Education Corner is sponsored by the Camella Foundation. The Camella Foundation is committed to relieving pain naturally using osteopathic healing principles. Here at the Camella Foundation, we envision a world where people achieve their maximum potential by being empowered with knowledge and skills to heal themselves and others. This information is to be used for educational purposes only, and not to be construed as medical advice. If you have any questions or concerns, please consult a licensed healthcare professional. Hello, it's Bill, the knee pain guru, and welcome to the Pain Education Podcast brought to you by the Camella Foundation. Today, we have a special guest. His name is Taryn Rosenthal. Now, Taryn and I go back a few years now. We've known each other for at least a decade, I believe. Somewhere around in there. And Taryn, I want to welcome you to the show.
Thanks, Bill. It's Taryn.
Taryn.
Yes.
Okay, Taryn. So Taryn, share with me your background, your experience, your training. I know you're into Chinese medicine.
Yep. How far back do we want to go? I mean, I was a movement geek as a kid. I was a dancer and studied a variety of martial arts. I would not claim any real proficiency in any of the ones I studied, but nonetheless was interested in movement generally and interested in bodies and how they worked. And, you know, as a kid, I think part of that was because I was not particularly embodied or bodyful in my initial orientation. And some part of me recognized that it would be useful and fun if I could learn how to be a little more in my own vehicle. So consequently, in that kind of exploratory process, I got injured, not a small amount, and had the opportunity to work with a lot of different kinds of practitioners to try to recover from those injuries. Some things seem to be more effective, some things seem to be less effective. But that definitely also catalyzed my interest in, you know, how does this body work? And what happens to it when it either through hazard or through maybe not the most optimal choices gets a little bit out of whack or substantially out of whack? And how can we help it come back into some kind of harmony and maybe even have the injury process be something that allows us to deepen our understanding of what it's like to be embodied? So I
wanted to just pause there for a moment. There was a few questions I had, and just for those that may not understand the term embodied, like what does that mean? Because I got a good idea what you mean, and I felt super awkward as a kid in terms of getting into sports and things like that. So can you just describe what that means to you?
I mean, on a certain level, I might even suggest that it's a little bit of a ruse to suggest that we can ever be anything other than embodied, right? Because like, if I was totally not embodied, I would not actually be alive. Right. So there's some level, even if I don't have the capacity for movement, like let's say that I was paralyzed, there's an aspect where I'm still in this body. So I just want to give a little bit of a bigger framing and say, you know, we talk about this a lot, but I think especially lately, I've come around to think that it's really a processual kind of relationship to awareness of what it's like to be living as a human, right? And so generally, I think when one is more or less embodied, it's how much resolution essentially do I have in my awareness of what it's like to be alive, right? And are there parts of myself where I can't perceive Are there parts of myself where I can perceive? What's it like to come into relationship with the parts that I can more deeply? And what is it like to enter into those places or spaces where maybe like it just seems to be an area of, you know, either the resolution is low or it's like there, I can't perceive anything at all. Right. So what I might suggest is that, at least for me, if there are aspects of my own being that I don't have the capacity to bring awareness into, that we might frame those as aspects where I'm not as embodied as I could be. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that helps clarify a little bit what we're talking about here.
Let me try to translate it to what's making sense for me. Is embodiment is a spectrum. You have on one end of the spectrum, maybe somebody that is paralyzed, that is not able to move. And on the other end, you have the gymnast, Olympic level gymnast, or the martial artist that is able to articulate every little nuance of themselves. And somewhere in there, we're falling. As you know, this is where I am in my embodiment, or my capacity to articulate my body or be aware of what's going on in my body. And the more we kind of increase towards that proficiency of movement, possibly.
Yeah, I would say possibly. One thing, and I take responsibility for bringing up paralysis maybe as an example of disembodiment, but I would want to decouple any particular example of what it looks like to be more or less embodied, because I've known plenty of gymnasts and martial artists who, while very skillful, I would not necessarily say we're very embodied. And I've known some folks that didn't appear to have any capacity for movement, whose perception and experience of what it is like to be in relationship to life in their body was incredibly refined. So it's not necessarily what it looks like, though often we see people that are more embodied do have some kind of capacity, movement quality that we can see if we tune into it. At the same time, it's not always this kind of like one-to-one correlation. And I think that's an important distinction, especially depending on, you know, we don't know who's listening. And I don't want to suggest to anyone that if they're not like a gymnast or a martial artist, somehow that means they have not,
right,
or they need to be either of those things in order to somehow be embodied or bodyful.
So there's, I hear you saying there's a depth to it. There's a quality to it that's not necessarily visible by looking at somebody.
Yeah, I think that there's definitely some truth to that.
Cool. Okay. Awesome. I don't want to like jump down that rabbit hole too far, but I just wanted to help those that are listening that may not have heard that term or be familiar with that term.
Yeah.
To get that. Okay, cool. Sounds like we were both similar when we were little. So your training, your exposure to different practitioners, your injuries. Tell us about your injuries.
We don't have enough time for that conversation. Suffice it to say that I, both through, like I was saying, maybe not the best choices or ways in which I was not entirely aware of choices I was making or not making, as the case may be, there's that kind of injury. And then there was plenty of hazard, car wrecks, like, you know, slipping and falling off of things. I've been injured a lot. It's been instructive. And sometimes I will joke, though the joke is that I don't think this is the only route, but I do think it's been my route, is that if one wants to work with pain and helping to alleviate suffering, then in some respect, being a connoisseur of such experiences has some utility.
What you're saying, I want to point this out, because that's what I've noticed in my interaction with those that have a proficiency for helping others. They've used the experience of the hazard, the injury, the accident, the surgery, the trauma, the pain that they're in as instructive, as a learning opportunity, looking at it as a third party objective observer of what's going on in their physical body as a tool to further levels of awareness, or maybe we could use the term embodiment.
Yeah, of I could do that too.
Their process. So I've also noticed that those that are really, really great at helping people out of pain, like yourself, would just look at it as like, oh, well, that's instructive.
I would actually go so far as to say it's been one of my greatest teachers.
Yeah.
Those kinds of experiences, if we kind of, and you know, it's a series of teachers and teachings. And with any luck, maybe I have graduated out of having to have such a robust form of instruction. But let's say that I was not exactly the sharpest tool in the shed. And apparently it took me a lot of very clear and incontrovertible kinds of classes to start to learn a little bit about this.
I so hear you. Go ahead. Keep talking.
You know, so there's that level of instruction, right? Mm-hmm. And then there, you know, and so some of that too would take me to folks that did chiropractic or did physical therapy or cranial osteopaths or, you know, various kinds of a broad range of body workers, folks that were practicing some branch of traditional East Asian medicine. Mm-hmm. And then lots of folks that taught various kinds of movement and breath work, other forms of somatic work, working with the emotions, working with how to process trauma that seems to be sort of lodged in the body somewhere. So, you know, there's been a pretty broad range of experiences that I've had as someone who's been in the position of seeking out support and working with my own material. You know, and that I think was a big part of what encouraged me to continue my own training as a mover and a body worker and eventually as a practitioner of classical Chinese medicine. Mm-hmm.
Is there one injury that sticks out? Like I could think of two or three in my life, a significant ankle injury when I was 11 and a knee injury when I was in high school. And then the big knee injury would got me into my day job when I was 28. They were like delineations in my life that it was like, if I went, that was a pivotal point. If I wouldn't have had that injury, the trajectory of my life would have been very different. Do you have any of those injuries that stick out a little bit more than the others?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there was one when I was 17. So I was primarily focused on dance training at the time and had a pretty clear, at least in my own mind and in the minds of the folks that were teaching me, trajectory that was coming into resolution of like, you know, conservatory dance training after high school and was, you know, on track for a professional career. And at a you know, in Georgia, there was this thing called the Governor's Honors Program, and they took kids from a variety of different disciplines across the state, you know, and if you had an aptitude for something, you could like audition essentially or test in. So I was at this program for dance, and I was at a social dance at the end of the first week of the program, which was a 6-week program. And it was in a gym, and there was this like, you know, very slick floor that had a protective covering on it that was supposed to keep folks from scuffing it. And I was dancing with one of my friends in the dance program and slipped in such a way that my foot got stuck and my knee had to go at an angle where what really gave was the medial collateral ligament. And I bounced my patella off my femur. It felt like someone had thrown a fastball into my knee. So I'm 49. That's 22 years ago. Suffice it to say that what was going on with orthopedic medicine 22 years ago, it was not as cool as it is these days.
Sure.
So the first assessment in Valdosta, Georgia was that I would never walk again, which of course turned out to be total nonsense. But what did I know? I was 17. I had been injured a number of times, but nothing this serious. And had surgery, a much more robust surgery than what folks would have done now. They could have done an arthroscopic and just pulled out the patellar fragment, and either the MCL would have healed or I would have figured out how to work around such things. But they did an open knee surgery, and it was pretty intense, and recovery took a really long time. So that was the first like major injury that forced me to slow down and reevaluate. Even though it happened through hazard, it really, because of the level of pain and the fact that it took a long time and that my, you know, my daily life, which was mostly school and dancing, in fact, almost entirely school and dancing, had to radically shift. Mm-hmm. I had to really like start to look at what was going on and how might I be able to find a different path than the one that I thought that I was on. So I ended up getting, you know, instead of going to a conservatory program, I went to the experimental theater wing at New York University's Tisch School of the Arts, which was a program that had a lot of what we would now call somatic practices as part of the curriculum. So a lot of going into one's own inner experience and working with the material that can be found there. And through that process, I really discovered that I could still dance. In fact, I could dance in ways that it never would have occurred to me to dance. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, kind of got back on the pursuing dance training path, but from a really different direction and much less of the kind of focused on performance and how it looks conservatory approach to really focusing on how does it work from the inside out and what kind of dancing does one do from the inside rather than like it needs to look like this. It's like, well, let's look at momentum and inertia and, you know, kind of a kinesthetic perspective and, you know, how does the body assembled from the inside and, you know, what are these kinds of capacities that are available if we explore movement, you know, from this kind of inside out orientation.
The piece that I'm really getting from what you're sharing is around the fact that you took the injury and allowed the injury to be what it was and learned from it and figured out a completely different path of how to move in your body that was, I don't want to say limited by your knee, but it gave a pause for that direction.
Yeah.
It went in another way. And I see people who get stuck with pain is it's like, oh, I'm not going to be able to move forward until whatever this is resolves. And they lock in there mentally and they don't see how there's a fork in the road. And we need to go in another direction for a bit.
Yeah. And, you know, maybe putting the cart before the horse here, I think one of the things that, at least with the folks that I work with, is incredibly important is, and this is not something that like one can give someone else. I can, in a clinical context, try to create a space, mm-hmm. or if you will, the context within that context for someone to see that the view often that we're holding when we get stuck in the way you're talking about is actually the thing that's getting us stuck. That while an injury is uncomfortable, while we certainly wouldn't wish pain and suffering, not that those are always the same thing, but we wouldn't wish those on anyone, that if we can change that relationship so that we can begin to hear whatever it is that's being offered to us about how we might find a way to navigate our experience in relationship to, as opposed to in opposition to, whatever is arising within us, that this can be the kind of fundamental shift, right? Where even if the pain is not totally gone, all of a sudden, it's no longer an experience of suffering, right? Like the pain becomes, oh, well, this is uncomfortable. I wish one day that I could be free of this, but at the same time, right? This is telling me something about choices that I have made and choices that I can make. And if I can open myself up to really listening and hearing that as you pointed out, right, it can take us in a direction that we might not have been able to imagine, which often seems to be a really useful one for folks.
Yeah. Could you go into the psychology of what you're talking about? Fascinates the daylights out of me. Like I like being able to look at a situation that seems hopeless, helpless, no options. There's no light at the end of the tunnel, that it's like a dead end. And then all of a sudden, someone like yourself comes in and says, well, have you looked at it this way? And all of a sudden it's like, Well, I haven't. No. Can you share your, I guess this is getting in the direction of how you work with people, your experience, your training, how that works with clients or someone suffering with pain?
Sure. So training, I was a body worker before I went to Chinese medicine school, and I was a body worker for a number of years. I studied Russian medical massage and neuromuscular therapy and sort of the obligatory Swedish massage and various forms of structural work that kind of broadly come out of Ida Rolf's, you know, the work that she brought. Not that I went to the Rolf Institute or the structural integration program, but I worked with a lot of folks that did and worked with a number of osteopaths. So it's kind of a, you know, my bodywork training was broad-ish. And that laid a foundation for the way that I relate to Chinese medicine pretty strongly, because there's a bunch of different ways. Like, traditional East Asian medicine should probably be traditional East Asian medicines, plural, and any one of those medicines from a particular region is definitely not homogeneous. It's incredibly heterogeneous. And so, you know, because we talk about it as Chinese medicine, people maybe even within the profession sometimes think of it as a thing, but it's really a variety of orientations to process, because that's the other thing, is that it's not a thing, right? It's fundamentally about change and movement. And that's kind of the basic paradigmatic underpinning of all of it, is that in the, you know, the arts that came out of the kind of proto-Taoist orientation to the observation of nature was that like things are always turning and moving and changing. And sometimes that happens in a more harmonious way, and sometimes that happens in a less harmonious way. And if they get stuck, inevitably that ends up becoming less harmonious and potentially even problematic in a way that can be disruptive to the system in such a fashion that it starts to break down. Right. So on one level, really what we're talking about is we're talking about allowing things to move and change, move and change in a coherent relationship with each other within the system. And then, because the idea that there is a system that's closed is entirely inaccurate from a certain point of view, that we're also looking, how does that set of systems that we call a human organism relate to the natural world and the cycles and patterns of movement in the natural world, right? In the turn of the seasons, in night and day, in, you know, these different kinds of movements and principles and energies that make up what we think of as an ecosystem. So that orientation, right, is, I think, really the crux of what unites many different aspects of all of these different types of medicine. But there's still, you know, I'm distilling it in a certain way and offering my perspective on it, right? So I wouldn't want to make any claims to be speaking for anyone else or how they view it. So, you know, I went to a graduate program for classical Chinese medicine at a school called Zhengdao School of Classical Chinese Medicine. It's in Sugar Grove, North Carolina. And like with many programs, you know, that in traditional cultures would have been long-term apprenticeships, like that we've turned into some kind of graduate education, those 4 years gave me enough of a knowledge base that I could really start to apply myself to learning the medicine, and that I could get a license and start working and probably do a little bit of good, be very unlikely to do any harm. I graduated in 2012 and started practicing in 2013. And from the beginning was doing a what at least in the Southeast is not super common, though there are some folks in Asheville that practice in this general way, but doing a combination of manual therapy and working with other modalities, needles, cups, gua sha, you know, bloodletting techniques, what have you, but putting my hands on everybody.
Gua sha, I'm not familiar with that. Gua sha is
a technique where you use some kind of implement to scrape the skin, which can either be used to change structure, like a sort of fascial remodeling relationship to it. Mm-hmm. The other idea is that by doing gua sha, you're releasing what we think of as the exterior to allow material that is stuck mm-hmm. in the interior to come to the surface so it can get out of the body. So this mm-hmm. could be heat or cold or typically stagnant blood are kind of the three main things we think about releasing the exterior to allow to come out.
And the scraping, and I'm just only going to use terms that I'm familiar yeah. with, Graston. I've heard of Graston technique.
Yeah, so Graston technique, like a lot of now trademarked and copyrighted techniques, are
yes.
somebody who saw something in Chinese medicine and said, that's cool,
right,
and took it out, or came to an understanding just because there are, you know, on some level, a limited number of things that we can do, right. and was like, oh, cool, I discovered yeah. this thing.
Okay.
So yes. So, okay. you know, yeah. similarly to dry needling, it's like a subset
okay.
of a thing we do, which is a whole other kind of conversation that we probably don't want to go
yeah,
down that
yeah,
particular
yeah.
rabbit hole at the moment.
I get it. Get it. I hadn't heard of it. Okay. Gua sha, you said bloodletting. That was mm-hmm. one of them. Brief on that. We don't want to go
rabbit brief. Hole. So like anybody who, super brief, if you've ever seen someone that has dark purple or black spider veins on their body, okay. we understand that to be stagnant blood, sometimes even if it's dark enough, dead blood mm-hmm. within the collateral system, which is one of the aspects of the channel system. And anytime something's not moving, as we talked about a couple of minutes ago, that produces not so awesome results.
Sure.
Generally pain and or some kind of illness mm-hmm. or maybe we're not seeing it manifesting as pain or illness yet, but it becomes down the road, right? It has the potential to throw the system offline in some way that's not advantageous.
Got it.
So a simple bloodletting technique is you just basically poke a little hole in one of those surface dark spider veins and allow the body, because the body is many things, and one of them is a system of fluid dynamics, to express mm-hmm. as much of that stale blood mm-hmm. as it wishes. And then, you know, you wipe that away. And this is understood, at least within the medicine, to allow for deeper levels of circulation to come back okay. online, right? Because, you know, you've got stuff that's stuck and deoxygenated and you take it out and essentially you're removing something that is toxic, for lack of a better word, out of the system so that the system can then start to re-regulate.
Right. Okay, cool. I mean, a lot of this information, I'm not, I've heard of it,
yeah.
not familiar to much of an extent other than my own experience of, it's like, okay, I'm going to pop a blister or,
yeah.
you know, which is a very rudimentary understanding of things, but no, this is awesome.
Thanks for tuning in to today's episode of the Pain Education Corner. If you have a special talent or skill to relieve pain and you'd like to become a guest on our show, visit us at thecamellafoundation.org/interview. Help us spread the word on eliminating pain and suffering in the world. That's thecamellafoundation.org/interview.
Okay.
So
working with clients, yes.
Yeah. And the final piece about that is that, so then that bodywork background that I had, right, there are numerous approaches to the medicine where people have more or less palpatory engagement with folks. Like certainly there's like taking pulses and maybe finding a point, but sometimes for people that practice Chinese medicine, like that's the extent of the hands-on work. Mm-hmm. But then there is this other kind of set of lines where, like, so tui na, which means push pull, is often the name that's given to a broad range of Chinese medical massage systems and or manual medicine systems. Mm-hmm. And I learned some of that in graduate school and then continued to study that pretty deeply with Tom Bizio and Frank Butler and Jen Resnick primarily. Mm-hmm. These days, mostly with Tom, who I also study internal martial arts with. And so this kind of like movement, manual medicine, inner transformatory process is at the heart of the kind of the way that I orient to the practice of Chinese medicine. So it's just a pretty important piece of that equation.
I've personally had experience with Tuina. Absolutely awesome. Love it. Would you kind of give, I know you said push pull, but could you give a little bit more in-depth description of what that is?
Yeah. I mean, so I would say that, like we were talking about in the embodiment bodyful part of the conversation, that there's a spectrum. So Tuina can go from like really robust things that are easy to see, where you are literally pushing and pulling the body, establishing visible waves through the system. There's a whole methodology around bone setting, you know, which both chiropractic and osteopathic medical systems have their own approaches to that. It's pretty different in Tuina. And, you know, nonetheless, there's that. There are organ regulating techniques, which if anybody's familiar with visceral manipulation and the work of Jean-Pierre Barral, who's a French osteopath, there's some consonance with that work. There are techniques that would look more like craniosacral techniques. So in the particular Tuina lineage that I'm a student of, we do, you know, we touch into all of that. We go from the very external kind of work to the very internal kind of work. And often we'll sort of, when it's good, seamlessly pass from the external to the internal. So you can start moving somebody's shoulder around and then you like, it turns into a fascial unwinding technique that then goes into the lung, and it turns out that their lung is restricted because the lung has a lot to do with how the rib cage and shoulder girdle have structural integrity. And so we work with the lung, and then it might, you know, pass into the channel pathway and then like come back. Oh, and then we're back in the shoulder and we're, you know, addressing how the humerus fits within the glenoid fossa and like, oh, cool. And then the bone sets, right? But we wouldn't like yank on somebody to try to pull the bone back into place without really addressing the fluid dynamics, the soft tissue dynamics, right? Muscular, musculo and fascial dynamics. And then we start to look at like, how does the bone float within that structural space?
Yeah.
So, you know, in the body work world, sometimes people will make a distinction between like, oh, massage is about working with the muscles. We don't, you know, we don't deal with the bones or the fascia or the organs. And that kind of looking at things as so separated is definitely not a Tuina orientation. We're kind of working with levels from, you know, the skin all the way down to the bone, right, and back out, and very much keeping this kind of aspect of how the fluids move and and relate and communicate within our palpatory set of references as we work.
That experience with the shoulder I've had with the Tuina practitioner in Louisville, Kentucky. His name was George Dominguez.
Cool.
And I had a shoulder injury when I was three. My shoulder was pulled out of the socket, and always had something going on with the shoulder. I had this experience with this Tuina practitioner that I was like, I couldn't believe the relief I had in my shoulder that I didn't even know I had,
like, awesome,
or I could have, potentially could have. So I'm definitely will testify for the efficacy of that modality. And it's pretty significant because they were describing to me, if I remember correctly, that it is very, very different than chiropractic, because chiropractic is going to be on the joint itself, where there was, at least the way this Tuina practitioner was doing it, it was on either side of the joint, the way they were moving.
Yeah, I would. So one of the ways that I would describe the difference between a set in a chiropractic context and a set in a Tuina context. So that thing I said about if I thought that something might need to be set, which I probably wouldn't be thinking it unless the person had an acute injury. If I found through palpatory engagement that something might need to be set, it's unlikely that in that moment I would try to set it. I would work with the tissues surrounding the area above mm-hmm. and below, in front and behind, and potentially considerably distal to the area that might need to be set, right? Until I felt that there was this capacity for coherence in a particular line through the body that relates to the area that might or might not need to be set, right? And then we would find that line, right? And create space. And then if the set needs to happen, the set's going to happen. Mm-hmm. The caveat yep. being, like, if we were training and, you know, somebody's jaw got dislocated, we would do our best to address that immediately without all of the other stuff. Because if something is acute, often you want to address it as quickly as possible. But generally, mm-hmm. people are not showing up in my office for something that they like that. And if they did, I'd most likely would tell them to go to the emergency room because sure. they live in the United States and that's the appropriate thing to do.
Sure.
But, you know, we're definitely not looking at grabbing the bone and putting it into a position mm-hmm. that we understand to be the correct one. There's a fundamental trust in the innate intelligence and healing capacity of the body mm-hmm. in such a way that we really seek to intervene as little as possible and as indirectly as possible when at all possible. Mm-hmm.
And indirectly, what I hear you saying, what I really hear you saying is that you're not necessarily going to go specifically to the problem, whatever that may be going on in the joint. You're looking at the compensation pattern that has taken place around the joint and in the body to relax that in the way where the joint almost does it itself. It's like it's just ready to just be back in where it wants to be.
Yeah. And the best of all possible worlds, that's absolutely how it works. Sometimes it can, you know, take coming at it from a variety of angles, but sure. there, you know, again, nothing is in isolation. It's all relational, mm-hmm. right? So this elbow is related to the shoulder and the wrist and the hand, obviously, but it's also related to, you know, the other shoulder, the hip, the, you know, the pelvis, the spine, the whole system. So if we focus on what hurts immediately, mm-hmm. we will often miss what's giving rise to that experience of pain, because mm-hmm. so often the thing that hurts is actually the end of a process, right? Mm-hmm. We're not talking again about acute injury, but like, you know, what does this person's pelvis look like? Mm-hmm. Like where, you know, is one hip higher than the other? Is it more or less forward or backward? Is it rotated? Mm-hmm. You know, and so if there is, and 99 times out of 100, when someone shows up in my office and they're in pain, which mm-hmm. is most of the people that come to see me come because they're in pain, mm-hmm. Their pelvis is pretty substantially out of what I would consider a relatively symmetrical alignment. Mm-hmm. And so if we don't work with what's going on with the pelvis and spine, and they're coming in for a shoulder problem, there's no possibility from my point of view of resolving that shoulder problem, right? Mm-hmm. Because do whatever you want to the shoulder. But if the pelvis is really in this, you know, twisted, lifted, rotated position, then all that can happen is the body can compensate, right? For the mm-hmm. way that the center has altered, right? Mm-hmm. And so if we can work to rectify what's going on in the center, we can start to really allow the systems, again, its innate intelligence, to come back online in a way that might deeply be compromised. I don't want to oversimplify. I'm not suggesting that if we just balance the pelvis, everybody's going to feel great. Mm-hmm. But what I would say is that if it's out of balance, substantively, it makes it really hard to get any kind of change.
Oh yeah. The pelvis plays such a huge role. It's hormone balancing and digestion and like, mm-hmm. Whether the body's in a sympathetic, parasympathetic state, the pelvis is out. It's everything else is going to be crazy. And what I really hear you saying is like, we can't forsake what's injured by just addressing the pelvis.
yet the pelvis plays a huge role in whatever in the body is injured.
Right. And maybe even more broadly, I would say, you know, even if we had 10 people that described their experience with the same words and pointed to the same place and had an MRI that said the same structures were damaged, every individual is different. And so even more than just looking at the pelvis, we want to look and see, you know, what, who is this being that is here and how is it that their system is expressing and asking for support, right? And how do we engage in such a way that we really can, again, with the least amount of intervention, help the system come back to the greatest level of the expression of its own innate intelligence and capacity to heal. Mm-hmm. So the techniques that we use in some respect are not as important as the orientation. Like, one needs to certainly have a nice broad tool set of ways that one can intervene technically. But I think even more important, right, is developing the view, right? Developing the capacity to see as deeply as possible, and then to not be attached to what it is that one perceives, because at the beginning, middle, and end of the day, does change happen? And does that change result in a greater level of coherence in the system? And then how does the person feel? Because, you know, at the same time, while we don't want to myopically focus on what hurts, people show up because they're something is wrong, and we want to do our best to help them.
Yeah.
So
how do you balance that? How do you balance the, because we want to look at the whole body and how the pelvis and the feet and whatever else is tying in with the issue that they're coming in for and the pain.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how do we, because I think it's a balance, because if I work on somebody's toe and release their toe and all of a sudden their shoulder pain goes away, they don't have any connection with the toe and the shoulder.
Mm.
So we have to have that. Okay. I may know what is going on, but if I'm not bringing the awareness of the person that's in pain along with me, then they're going to be back in that same place again, because they haven't got the connection. I haven't brought their awareness with me. And at the same time, if I go and if it is the shoulder and I fix the shoulder and the pain goes away, they don't have any, there's no growth there either.
I think people have a variety of levels of interest in their own process.
Mm-hmm.
And my preference is to engage as deeply as possible, but that's not what everybody's always interested in.
Right.
And so, you know, I try to really meet people where they are and encourage them to maybe go a little deeper, but a little deeper, not always as deep as it's possible to go. I mean, if somebody wants to, great. But even so, I think that needs to happen in some kind of progressive fashion, you know, so that their healing crises happen, but I do my best to avoid cultivating a space where they're likely, right? My preference is that people have, and certainly sometimes people are sore after, or even have an increase in the symptoms that they're being treated for after treatment, but I try to minimize that as much as possible. And you know, I frame the work as being collaborative and cooperative. So I'm in both verbal and nonverbal dialogue with the folks who I work with in every session at some point along the way. And I will often have people, like when we're working on a structural issue, which is not the only thing I treat, but I definitely treat a lot of those kinds of concerns, we'll test it out. Right. So like somebody comes in and we check out their range of motion and we do some work and we check it again, you know, and we check it in not just let's go with the shoulder again. We check, you know, the shoulder range, but we'll also check what's going on in the neck. You know, we'll check how those things move together. We'll check the other arm, you know, we'll take a walk. We'll see how it feels. So what I'm looking for, right, is a change that I can perceive, but also a change that the person can perceive. And mm-hmm. so I work with them to increase the resolution of their perception in our work so that we are moving together on whatever the path is.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I got one more question. I want to respect your time because we're getting closer to the top of the hour.
Cool.
This is good because my own personal experience in my own healing process was if I didn't have this level of self-abuse in the process of the healing, it almost like I wasn't doing it right.
Mm.
Meaning like I needed to be sore or I needed to feel it or it needed to be a struggle. And I think that may be true for many people out there in their healing process. Like, well, it can't be easy. It can't be, you know, it's gotta be like this. Ugh. I really feel like it did something in order for the healing to take place. How do you work with clients like that? And then we'll tie this up here. We'll put a bow on.
I mean, sometimes it is like that, right? Sometimes it is hard work, but it doesn't have to be hard work.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, you know, that's a whole long conversation as to why we might have that cultural orientation. Right. And again, it's sort of in the spirit of meeting people, right. In, you know, having the encounter of being to being, right? Here we are in this space working together, right? And being open to the possibility that this process, in some respects, by its nature, can't be what we expect it to be, right? Because what we expect it to be is what we've been doing, what we know. And so the opportunity of healing, from what I understand it to be in my own life and in my work, is moving into something that we don't know. Right. Yep. And so part of that, I think, at least in the way that I've been trained, you know, is that we don't push it absolutely to the limit, right? Like in a lot of the internal martial arts practices, there's this idea of a 70% rule where like whatever the boundary is, you go to 70%. Right. You don't work until you fall down. You know, you don't push the absolute limit of range. You kind of like, as you work within what is comfortable with a slight level of like, whoa, I don't know about this. You know, you stay in that liminal space, and then where that boundary is changes over time. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think I wish that I had some like, oh, well, it's like this and it's like that. But I think this work is entirely happening within that boundary space of like, we have to be really uncomfortable not knowing and have a truly experimental orientation to the work. Because what I tell virtually everyone is that all medicine is experimental. I'm willing to cop to that here with you. We never know what's going to happen. Even if I've treated ostensibly what is the same thing countless times, we never know what's going to happen until we start to engage. And we just have to take it one step at a time and work together to find what is for you at this time, the path with the least amount of resistance through this particular part of the landscape.
Mm-hmm.
If that makes sense.
Yep. Yeah, it does. It does. Tarn, I want to thank you so much for taking your time today to speak with us. Do you work with clients remotely?
I don't. I am an entirely hands-on kind of practitioner.
Type of person.
Yeah.
Okay.
Definitely.
If somebody was interested in reaching out to bounce something off of you or maybe talk with you further, is that something that would possibility? Okay.
Yeah.
Then what we could do is we have listeners all over the United States, as North America and the world as well. So we can direct them to you. We also have a pain relief portal where a woman is doing remote muscle testing that test based on, they send in certain information and she muscle tests for who
would be able to help them the most at this point in time. So we have that set up in addition to the podcast. But anyhow, we will get that set up. So your contact information, the ability of people to get in touch with you will be below this on the website, the Camella Foundation website. And yeah, once again, I truly want to thank you for taking the time to speak with us today. I think it was wonderful. I would actually like to have you on a future one to go into the whole.
Let's do it.
The conversation around the need for pain.
Yeah.
In the healing process.
Yeah.
That's a great one. So
well, Bill, thank you so much. It's been a total pleasure. I will look forward to the next time.
Awesome. So Taryn, thank you so much for being here. This is Bill Paravano, the knee pain guru, thanking you for being here on the Pain Education Podcast brought to you by the Camella Foundation. Thanks again, and we will see you on the next episode.
Thank you for tuning into this week's segment of the Pain Education Corner. Join us next week for another conversation on natural healing methods to eliminate pain. To learn more about the work we do at the Camella Foundation, please visit our website at the Camella, C-O-M-E-L-L-A, foundation.org.